Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. From the lost boys in the UK to the anxious generation in the US, this week we're learning about a global breakdown in community with two siblings who've decided to take action and help families create their own unique culture. Family culture encompasses core values, traditions, beliefs, and behaviours that define and shape interactions with their community and the world around them. Influenced by a family's history, experience, and external cultural forces, it is the thread that binds a family together, fostering a sense of belonging, identity, and shared purpose. That's something my guests, Stephen Shapiro and Nancy Shapiro Rapport, who are former educators, want everyone on the planet to benefit from. Their life experience underpins the foundations of their app, Our Family Culture. I'd like to welcome you both to the show. Stephen, I'll start with you. Why did you choose education as a career path?
Well, I think as a young person, I had a few teachers who were different from the norm. They weren't just going through the motions. They weren't just passing me a textbook or lecturing at me and giving me multiple choice tests, but they were actually really engaging me and thinking about what was possible in my life. And people always told me, you'd be a great lawyer, you should be a lawyer, and I applied to law school. But what I really came down to is there was something really powerful about that kind of connection I had with a teacher, where you're actually shaping the future and the direction of someone's life. And I was really lit up by the idea of having that kind of impact and spending my days in that creative, generative growth space. And so I wanted to live in that world, and that's why I chose to become an educator.
Very honourable. I'm loving that little story. Nancy, why did you choose the counselling aspect?
Well, I started as an English teacher for the first 5 years of my career, but something happened as I was working. I had a student who passed away unexpectedly on the heels of starting a school year where my father had just passed away as well. And I found myself in a space of grief, deep grief personally, and my students were also in a place of deep grief. And together we worked with one another and supported each other. And I ended up working with them throughout the course of the year to try and learn how to manage and figure out how to live through the death of a classmate. And they were a tremendous support for me in turn.
We see a lot of children having to deal with that level of grief. Where do you begin to help children heal when they've experienced such trauma?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I think it starts with just really sitting together and being present and listening to what kids are feeling. The notion of death when you're an adolescent is so, well, for all of us, frankly, it's a little bit hard to wrap our heads around sometimes, but it just doesn't make sense for young people when they lose someone. And so it's just being together and listening to what their fears are, what their, you know, they get scared for their own longevity. And sometimes they don't have someone to talk to even to really share how they're feeling. So it was just really a lot of being together and working through some of the biggest fears and biggest sadnesses they were experiencing.
America has seen a lot of trauma, particularly in schools around the gun culture. In Australia, we're seeing more knife crime since we disarmed the country many, many years ago. Not that that stops guns from coming in. How do we talk to children about that level of trauma and crime to prepare them for the real world?
Well, I think in American schools, we still have things like drills where kids practice active shooter response and how we deal with that. And I think that's always in the background of kids' experience. Although I will say this, I think that the gun trauma and violence trauma gets a lot of media attention. But I think right now in the United States, and I think across the world, we're experiencing a real crisis in youth mental health that goes far beyond that. And it's, I think it's rooted in a lot of the anxieties, depression and loneliness that kids are experiencing right now as they go through a world that is really complex and really challenging. And I think part of our work with parents is the recognition that it's really complex raising a child these days, because kids are going through a really different experience because of technology than we experienced. And a lot of parents don't really exactly know how do we go about raising a healthy kid, an emotionally healthy kid in this context.
From your experience, and that includes the time you spent at school as well as your career in schools as an educator, what's changed the most that you've noticed in children generationally?
I mean, I think Stephen alluded to it. We say often how grateful we are that when we raised our children, the iPhone hadn't been invented yet. But clearly, we know from the attention that books like Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation is, that the accolades that it's getting in and attention, at least in the United States. I'm not sure if it's making a splash in Australia as well. But I think that people are absolutely, at least in my experience in working with middle school students, they were exposed to things that were so far beyond their comprehension level. They were talking with adults, strangers in other, they didn't even know where they were. Of course, they were having experiences where I would ask them questions and they wouldn't be able to tell me who it was they were talking to, or they would believe the descriptions that they were getting. And so I think that was always a little bit frightening to me. They're exposed to things they're just not ready to handle, whether it's violence or people who are not who they say they are, or goodness, it could be a number of things.
I would say there are also two things related to the social media environment that are very important for kids. One of them is there's a constant sense of other kids are happier than I am. Other kids are living their best life and I'm not. So there's always a sense of the FOMO. I'm missing out on something. I'm not included in something. They're seeing pictures of a party they're not at, or they're posting something on social media and it's not getting a lot of attention, and they feel alone and they feel like unseen or unnoticed. So that's one factor. I think on the other side is that there is a huge industry of people who call themselves influencers. Their job is to influence, and kids are the target of a lot of that influence. And some of it is commercial. So there's a huge wave of people now trying to convince 11 and 12-year-old girls that they need to do very expensive skincare regimens, for example. And there are also people who are influencing ideas. And so you look at, I think one of the most controversial is Andrew Tate, who's a misogynistic influencer that's influencing a lot of teenage boys to adopt beliefs that are antithetical to their family's basic core beliefs. And a lot of parents are thinking, how did my kid suddenly become like this? Or how did my kids suddenly start to espouse these beliefs? Where do we go wrong? And I think this goes back to, I think, this whole idea of family culture and why we believe that right now it's so much more important for parents to be really rock solid in raising kids with clarity. Because of all this competition in social media and with influencers, it's easy for your kids to follow a different path if you haven't built a really strong foundation at home.
You know, I was born in the 60s, like the late 60s, and my parents had a business and we were raised very independently. I was responsible for a lot of home duties. However, we still had a very strong moral base and we still spent a lot of time with our parents, even if it was at their business. Where do you think things have changed predominantly in the family dynamic that it's necessary to create a pathway to a family culture?
I would say one of the things that has happened over the last 30, 40 years is there's been a breakdown in community. So I think in our era, when we were growing up, families were more likely to be part of shared value communities, and whether those were religious communities or small town communities. And so if our parents didn't do an amazing job at promoting their values, it was okay because those values were probably going to get replicated or reinforced when you went to Sunday school or when you went to your youth softball team or basketball team, the coach was going to be part of your community. Your teachers might have lived in the small town that you lived in. So I think there used to be a lot more reinforcement of a family's values. And I think now two things have happened. One is we've had a breakdown of community. So people are less involved in organized religion. People are less involved in community civic organizations and so forth. But also we have so much more competition from the outside. So it's less reinforcement of your family's values and more competition. So those two things combined put a lot more pressure on parents to be intentional and powerful in their family cultures because they lose those two reinforcement factors that we had when we were growing up.
We've also been through a lot of changes in parenting styles. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, there was a focus on behavioral parenting where it was behaviors and consequences. Then we've shifted to another style of parenting, which was a little bit more child focused. What's the basis of a great family culture that's cohesive as well as being able to be influential through to the adolescent years?
I think when we talk about building family culture, we're not talking about a particular style of parenting. In fact, we're not talking at all about how we think people should parent. Our family culture, as we see it, when we're talking about building family culture, we're talking about identifying the behaviors that you really want your kids to espouse, and then practicing them over and over and over again until they just become part of who your family is, who your kids are, who you as parents are. You know, when you try to think about values, when we think about the values we want our kids to have, really values can be nebulous because different people can take different meaning from them. And so when we talk about behaviors, the values are steeped into those behaviors. So when we work with families, when we're talking about working with building family culture, we have behaviors such as listen generously. And that might be a behavior where the value is we want to connect deeply with people. So you have to be able to listen generously to connect. We have practice kindness. And so practice kindness is about having a good sense of empathy and a sense of humanity within yourself. Or we might have a behavior like bounce back. And bounce back is we're trying to work on the value of sort of not letting things get the best of you. When something bad happens or when something disappointing happens or when something frustrating happens, we bounce back. So the behavior helps to guide the direction of the value that we're thinking about.
Stephen, resilience, as Nancy was just talking about, is a huge issue, along with many other emotional intelligence strengths and human traits we need to really instill in the generations of the future. A lot of it comes down, though, to modeling that as parents. So what's the most challenging thing about bridging that divide we currently see?
Well, I think that you said something really important, which is that parents' modeling is huge. And one of the things that we tell parents as they choose their family fundamentals, families that work with us in our family culture, and it, again, it's a simple app delivery. So we have people all over the world who are practicing this. Once you identify the family fundamentals you want to center your family on, you have to live those as parents. Our family culture is not about fixing your kids or making your kids into something. It's a family culture, which means we're all participating in it. I love you use the example of resilience. So I struggled at one point where something happened in my job that I thought was really problematic, and it really knocked me off course. And I had to bounce back. I had to really figure out a new way. I actually left my job. I found a new job. I took action. And I think it's one of the most important things as a parent that I ever did, which was show my kids, this is what we do. When we got knocked off course, this is what we do. Another example in our family, which was really powerful. My daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when she was 4 years old. And my family immediately said, we are going to raise money for a cure for this disease. And we rallied our friends, we rallied our neighbors, we rallied our communities. We raised hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of a decade to fund diabetes research. And that was us saying, we're not going to get knocked off course by this. We are going to bounce back. We're going to take action to make a change. And so I think once a family identifies their fundamentals and what they're about, absolutely, it's important that parents live those fundamentals every day because kids are watching us. And I think beautifully with our family culture, once you have that language and you start practicing a fundamental, your kids will call you on it if you're not living up to it, which is also kind of beautiful.
Nancy, change is a huge psychological key in building humans who are resilient and capable of adaptation. Yet it's one of the things that humans fear most because there's a sense of uncertainty. Stephen just pointed out he's obviously been great at taking a risk and looking at change from that perspective. But how do we make children comfortable with change and adaptability?
I think the same way you both have just mentioned, and it's by modeling that. If we demonstrate fear or an unwillingness to accept change or to do something different when something isn't going the way we're hoping it will, then we're teaching that same fear or lack of desire to make things different to our kids. And so in order to be able to help kids feel safe in making changes, they have to see you being able to do that too. You know, Stephen talked about when my niece Rachel was diagnosed with diabetes. I mean, our families have been through a lot, and recognizing those things and knowing that change can be imminent. And in some cases, like for example, when my kids were very young, 3 and 6 years old, I got diagnosed with breast cancer, and they were so young, and I was afraid I wasn't going to live long enough to raise them. And I knew that that was not something that I could let happen. Now, I didn't have a whole lot of control over that. I had to trust in a lot of other people. But for my kids, it was important for me to demonstrate to them that I was going to do everything necessary to take care of my health the way that my doctors and the way that all the professionals I work with recommended, because I wanted to be able to live a long, healthy life to be able to raise them.
When I was younger and my children and I were moving from Gladstone, which is where they were born, where my parents had raised me, where we had a lot of family and friends, to a completely unknown Mackay, where I live now, where we had no friends, we had no family, we had no connections. It was just a completely new start. I actually took that change one step further and didn't just model that, you know, this is okay and it's actually exciting, but it was an opportunity to reinvent myself, themselves, to meet new friends. And I tried to make it, you know, as exciting as possible, so that not only weren't they fearful, they were actually looking forward to it. You know, what does it say about the human condition when children can be so adaptable at an early age, given the ideas we can actually present to them?
Yeah, I think what you described there is so important because you had clarity about what was important and what you wanted to teach. You actually made a conscious decision. And as a result, you modeled and you taught your kids something. And I think this is part of the challenge in a really hectic world that we live in now, is that A, we don't always take the time to say, what are these core things that we want to teach our kids? That's number one. And then number two, we sometimes wait for something, life event to happen for us to teach them. So you moved and that was the chance to teach them. And so I think if you want to teach your kids to have integrity, sometimes we don't think about it until they steal something from the corner store and then we're like, oh, this is a good chance to teach my kid about integrity. But of course, in a perfect world, we should be proactive in teaching our kids about integrity before they steal something from the corner store. And so I think a lot of this is about saying, what is it that we care most about? What are these behaviors or these values that are really foundational to our family that we really want our kids to grow up with? And then how do we teach them intentionally and purposefully, as opposed to hopefully if something happens that gives us the chance to?
Stephen, it's funny you use that example, because when my son was very young too, he stole a Baby Bell cheese, which is a little wrapped one, from Woolworths. And I didn't find it until we got outside, and I marched him straight back to the counter and I made him produce it to teach him a lesson. Now, he was 2. So that was a very difficult one. Obviously, she wasn't going to call the police and she wasn't going to do much about it. In fact, they found it quite funny and I'm like, this isn't helping me. But later on, when he was a teenager, he actually encountered an even worse situation with theft because he was being influenced by his peers. That's a really difficult thing to guard against. So you're talking about intentionally teaching these lessons. What about family culture is it that steals us with these values and morals that will actually supersede those peer pressures that they will encounter in adolescence?
I think the key is making sure that we start when our kids are young and making sure that we're right on course with what it is that we want to be teaching our kids. If we don't have a goal, if we don't have a target to aim at, then we're just shooting at things and hoping we catch something. So I think when we start young, when we make it clear, when our kids know this is who we are, the Shapiro family values hard work. The Shapiro family values showing up for other people. We value practicing kindness and helping out strangers. And so when you're able to constantly have conversations and share with your kids what it is you're aiming at, what your goal is as a family, then by the time they get to the point where they've got their peers coming to wreak havoc, they already know who they are.
And I think that what Nancy's saying is really borne out in James Clear's book, Atomic Habits. And he talks about in Atomic Habits, if we try to break habits by saying, I'm going to not do that, it's a lot harder than if we say, this is who I am. So if you, for example, try to stop eating junk food when you go into the convenience store, that's hard. But if you define yourself as someone who is a healthy living person, when you walk in the convenience store, you don't even look at the things in the store because that's not what a healthy person does. And I think the idea of building family culture is to say, it's not just what we do, it's what it means to be a Shapiro. It's what it means to be a Clyden. This is who we are. The families that we observed who had kids that were really amazing kids during our education careers were those families where it was clear what that family was about. And you could have multiple kids from that family and they stood for something. And I think all of us aspire to have kids that are like rock solid, clear about who they are. And then when they get with their friends, they may go along to get along. But when things get messy, they're like, I'm out. This is not for me.
Stephen, the one thing that's become very clear speaking to you and your sister, Nancy, is that your roots and foundations have come from a very strong place. So what was it about your parents and the way you were raised that's created this really deep cultural connection?
Stephen and I would both answer this the same way, which was we had a pretty extraordinary father. And I mentioned when I talked about what drew me to school counseling, our dad died when he was 56 years old. So what we appreciated about him, and our mom is tremendous in her own right, but she is as lighthearted as my dad was serious. And so we feel like he some of the just natural things he did demonstrated to us what was important. And so, for example, we would come downstairs sometimes and find him with headphones on, listening to the music that we liked, not the music he liked, because he wanted to understand what it was we were listening to and be able to have conversations with us about that. Our home was always open, like the door was unlocked and people would always, our home was the welcoming place where anyone could come over at any time. And when you came over, in fact, we weren't going to offer you snacks and drinks because it was your home too. Help yourself, get some snacks, get some drinks, and just feel at home here. And our dad was very intentional. And I don't know if he meant to be intentional or not, to be honest. He just made us feel like we were important and he had us. He had us. And he also taught us some really important lessons. And Stephen, you'll probably remember more than me because, of course, you're older than me. But
you had to get that one in, Nancy, didn't you?
You had to get that in, didn't you?
But I think, you know, I think about sometimes, like, there was somebody where my dad worked. He didn't have a car and he had a family and he didn't know how he was going to be able to get his family, help his wife and get his kids to school. And my dad, he offered him a car that we were not going to be using anymore. Instead of like trying to sell it and make money or do anything like that, he gave the car to the person that he worked with so that he could help make his life a little bit better. It might not have gone exactly like that, but that's what I remember. And what I remember taking from that is like, well, our dad is generous. Our dad is thoughtful and considerate. He cares about other people and he has empathy. And that taught us how to recognize and have empathy for others.
And it was all these lovely things, but it was also high expectations. He thought, you know, if we came home and said, oh, I got a 98 on my test at school, he'd say, good job. What'd you miss? I mean, it was a joke, but he was saying like, you're smart. You should be, you can get it all. Like there's no limit to how successful you can be. And so it was all those things in small ways that reinforced what it was that we were about. And one of the beauties of this is that our father died before our kids were born. He never got to meet our kids, and it's one of the great sadnesses of our lives because he would have been such an amazing grandfather. But the strangest thing happened, Kim, which is as our kids grew, we started to see our father in our kids, even though he had never met them. And the reason is because he had taught us so many things that were so strong in us that we were just naturally bringing those to our kids. And that's the generational legacy of parenting. When we build really strong cultures, when we raise our kids with really clear values, it shows up generations after we're gone. And that's the incredible power of parenting and the incredible legacy that's available to every great parent.
You two are absolutely amazing. I can only imagine what your children are like. But even with this strong foundation and this understanding of culture, have you been challenged at any point during raising your children?
Oh my gosh. Don't get me started. I actually have a son who has autism, and he was diagnosed with autism 3 weeks before I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so raising my son, who is the most amazing soul, but he has a lot of complications that make things that are easy for many people challenging. I think just that alone, when Stephen was talking about my dad and how he, you know, what did you miss? I mean, I think about the fact that he constantly was trying to help us be our very best. And I've thought so many times in the times that I've had my, you know, my son is now almost 28 years old. I always think about if my dad were still alive, he would have created something for my son to live into, meaningful work, meaningful life experience for my son. And so I am constantly, it's not easy, but I am constantly trying to figure out what I can provide for my son or create for my son so that he can have as meaningful of a life as he possibly can, despite some of the challenges that he faces.
Yeah, I would say one of the other challenges is, in addition to the challenges with our kids, it's parenting with our partners. And when we come from different places. And so my wife and I are very in line in most of our shared values, but there are places where we're different. And so part of the challenge that we had to overcome is, if I think something's important and she thinks something else is important, what happens when those things are in conflict with each other? And part of what we're helping parents do with our family culture is identify what's important, talk about it, and be open about it. So when two different values are in conflict, parents have a way to say, I see why that's important to you. I see why this is important to you. How do we help our kid live both of those things successfully?
I'm so grateful to the two of you for joining me today. And I think we've got a lot more to explore because, Nancy, one of the things that came up for me earlier was, does neurodivergence challenge the presentation of some of the cultures that you want to introduce to your family? Because not all children are receptive to a certain way of introducing new ideas. So I think that's one thing. And Stephen, the couple stuff is going to be very interesting to explore as well. So let's do something again.
Kim, we would love to. It's such a pleasure to talk with you.
Absolutely. Anytime you want to talk, it's always such a pleasure talking with you, Kim.
Stephen Shapiro and Nancy Shapiro report. Siblings who are looking to help facilitate building a foundation for your family based on the things that are important to you. If you'd like to connect with Stephen and Nancy or look at the Our Family Culture website, all those details are in the show notes. And to connect with me, you can go to my website or follow What We Teach Our Children on Facebook. All of those links to my socials are at kimclidon.com. That's KimKleidon. And I look forward to bringing you another fabulous conversation next week. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Greater Whitsunday Innovation, formerly Split Spaces.